Well, here with us in the studio is Brian Wilson, visiting from Nicaragua. Welcome back to Portland, Brian.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming into KBOO this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Let me give you I'll try to be brief with my introduction, and then we'll talk about Nicaragua. Brian Wilson first became an anti-war activist after serving in the U.S. Air Force in Vietnam from 1966 to 1970. He became a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War and Veterans for Peace, and hasn't stopped actively opposing U.S. wars. As a lawyer and writer, he has documented U.S. war crimes in nearly two dozen countries. And in his long activist history, he has participated in actions of nonviolent civil disobedience, lengthy fasts, and tax refusal, along with voluntary simplicity. On September 1, 1987, while engaged in a protest against the shipping of U.S. weapons to Central America in the context of the Contra Wars, Wilson and other members of a Veterans Peace Action team blocked railroad tracks at the Concord, California Naval Weapons Station. An approaching train did not stop and struck the veterans. Wilson was hit, ultimately losing both legs below the knees. Subsequently, he discovered that he had been identified for more than a year as an FBI domestic terrorist suspect under President Reagan's anti-terrorist task force provisions, and that the train crew that day had been advised not to stop the train. There are several documentaries about Brian Wilson's work. I recommend to listeners the 2016 documentary, Paying the Price for Peace, The Story of S. Brian Wilson and Other Activists. And he's authored several books, two of which we want to talk about today, Don't Thank Me for My Service, My Vietnam Awakening to the Long History of U.S. Lies, just published last year, and as a co-author of the recent collection Live from Nicaragua, Uprising or Coup. And Brian, this new collection, Live from Nicaragua, published by the Alliance for Global Justice, and people can download the PDF there on the website, Alliance for Global Justice, and I think actually a lot of anti-war sites have that available. And that collection upends the narrative that everyone heard last year about the U.S. coup attempt in Nicaragua, of course, which the U.S. media and even much of the media on the left portrayed as this democratic uprising against the autocratic Daniel Ortega. Now, you've been living in Nicaragua, and of course, you've been actively involved in the country, opposing U.S. interventions since the 1980s. Tell us what happened or what's actually been happening there.
Well, the attempted coup broke out on April 18th, 2018, with a blitzkrieg of what we now think were millions of sites, WhatsApp sites, Facebook sites that were purchased. And I don't understand how all these platforms work and how the algorithms work, but there was a script, you know, pretty much the U.S. neoliberal State Department script, talking about a repressive government, how they massacre their citizens and don't have any free press, and they need to be removed. That script went out all over the world with a click of a mouse, and social media as well as corporate media just kind of repeated the script. And the script, which was somewhat similar to the script that the United States promoted for Syria and Libya and in the past and still currently in Syria and in Venezuela and so forth, is the new kind of the new template for humanitarian intervention, which ironically a lot of the NGOs get on board promoting these overthrows or what we call regime changes. So the church is involved, the NED is involved, National Endowment for Democracy, U.S. Agency for International Development is involved. When I say the church, I mean the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, which has always been supporting the rich for 500 years in Latin America, and the rich, and the ex-Somocista and ex-Contras from the 80s. They all represent a small cabal of wealthy people who want to regain power so that they can privatize everything and keep the money for themselves. That's basically what happens. And initially, there was a lot of confusion because the news was overwhelmingly saying that the dictator Ortega must go. He's repressive. And they, I believe, the perpetrators and the NED and the U.S. Embassy, I believe, all believed that with the millions of money they had, dollars they had behind them, they were going to be successful in a very short period of time because that blitzkrieg of information, the narrative, was so predominant in day after day after day in social media and in corporate media. Only those of us who lived in Nicaragua knew that this was all a fake. It was not true. And I was shocked. And so I and 23 other people started putting together, who live in and around Nicaragua, in Nicaragua in various parts, or visit Nicaragua many months each year. We started saying, we got to antidote this with what we now know from being on the ground in Nicaragua, what really was happening. And realizing that this is kind of the U.S. template for how regime change works. Humanitarian intervention then becomes adopted by the NGOs, including Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, of course NED, which is, that's its function. But it's very shocking to realize that the facts don't seem to matter. The narrative matters. And I'm a trained lawyer, so I'm trained to develop evidence that supports a particular position. And since Vietnam, I have realized that much of what my government told me and what my Sunday school teachers told me and what my parents told me and what my community told me was not correct about Vietnam. That was my first real experience with lying, how lying works. So I was very conservative, and I had no inch. I didn't even know what an activist was. I was just going to be a good lawyer and make money and live happily ever after in the American dream, when in the 60s you could still kind of conceive of that for yourself as a white male. The late 60s, no, but the early 60s, it was a piece of cake. That life was great in the United States. So when I realized that I couldn't trust what the government was saying, and then I couldn't trust what much of the media was saying, I had to join other people that I was meeting in the 70s, that we have to kind of regroup. And for me, I had to relearn history. I actually had an obsession with learning the details of ancient history, European history, American history, world history, because it's the context that's so important in understanding what's happening in the moment, because the moment has a lot of things preceding it that kind of guide what's happening in the moment, especially by the politicians. So,
and that's partly what motivated you to write this book, Don't Thank Me for My Service.
Right.
Really reflecting back on your Vietnam years and how that shaped your view of history and how the realities on the ground actually altered, well, plus all the activism at the time, altered your
right.
way of thinking. And so this book, Don't Thank Me for My Service, really is a sweeping view of U.S. history, which is a history of imperialism and violence around the world.
The first third of the book is a radical history of the United States going back to the 1600s. And then that leads into a long piece on the Cold War, because the indoctrination that I grew up with was so overwhelmingly convincing that there was an enemy that was going to take away our freedoms. And we had to be vigilant to make sure we could preserve our freedoms with this enemy lurching everywhere. I thought there was a communist in every town, in every closet practically. But in my little farming community, everybody thought that way. This was in the 50s. But the indoctrination was almost cult-like. I mean, it's overwhelming. I wanted to understand why it was so easy for me, who was supposedly a good student, to obey orders to go 10,000 miles away with weapons and training to kill people. I didn't even know them. I didn't know their history. So I had, you know, it occurred to me, and while I was in the military, and especially in Vietnam, that the conditioning that I had experienced was so intense, and I was a representative, typical of the society, that how is it that some men knew this was not a valid policy to be obedient to? I didn't have a clue, really, and that it's kind of shameful in a way, and I'm still living with the fact that I participated in a murder machine, thinking that this was the patriotic thing to do, when in fact it was, I was a mercenary. We were mercenaries. We were murderers. We were arrogant, you know, American, U.S. Americans. So realizing all that is what's been the foundation for my activism, but I wasn't planning to be an activist. I was drafted out of law school. I was going to do my military service and become a lawyer. I did become a lawyer after the military, but I was so different in my views, I couldn't even follow the protocol of the courtroom, and I left the law very early.
Well, that critical thinking and activism since the 1960s led you to relocate to Nicaragua a couple of years ago. But just in the little time that we have here, let's talk more about why this hegemony in the media, this refusal to really recognize what was happening on the ground, and also just compared to other Central American countries. I mean, since 2006, is it, when the Sandinistas regained power?
2007, yeah.
What had actually been happening in Nicaragua compared to its neighbors in Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala?
You mean before 2006?
No. Just...
Well, now everybody in Nicaragua has health care, everybody has education. There's almost continuous, uninterrupted electricity everywhere. There's roads into the most remote areas now. Virtually all women get zero interest loans if they're going to want to start a small business. The gender equity in Nicaragua is 50-50. It's the law. It's certainly the most progressive country in Central America, and certainly one of the most in all of Latin America. Maybe Bolivia and Uruguay are also very progressive. That's why those countries are targeted, because they're examples of how people can move away from obedience to the imposed neoliberal model that the U.S. wants, with all their cohorts in the oligarchic structures of all those countries that are always in cahoots with the Catholic Church, by the way. Historically. So, for me, Nicaragua represents a more humane culture, far more progressive than the United States, far safer than the United States, violence, despite what the media says. And unfortunately, I still am struggling with my Spanish, so I'm not a very good learner of another language, and I'm 78 now, so it probably makes it even all the more difficult to learn another language.
The point is that Nicaragua hasn't had the violence that its neighbors, El Salvador,
right.
has actually kept out much of the drug trafficking and violence that
has.
I'm
very adamant about it.
And who don't really represent many of the migrants at the U.S. border.
Very small number.
But that's something else, that the media has not looked at the context the migrants who have been forced to flee
Correct.
Of these other...
They miss it all the time. There's five major corporations that own all the media, or 98% of the media. The print media, the TV media, the radio media, the Hollywood media, basically. So those five or six corporations, basically... They're part of the script. They're part of the neoliberal script, and that's how they make their money. And that's why alternative media is so important, like Habu and Gray Zone and Consortium News and so forth, because we can't depend upon the corporate media. We can't depend upon them at all.
And, of course, that corporate media is tied in with the social media, as you described,
right,
in this 21st century coup.
That's right.
That social media assisted.
It's shocking to me. I couldn't believe that a lot of my left friends from the 80s support these regime change operations that the U.S. is orchestrating around the world. What? How about regime change in the U.S.? Who's going to suggest that, and who's going to organize that? I mean, we don't have any moral or legal authority to tell anybody anything.
Well, Brian Wilson, I thank you so much for coming into KABU today, and we want to tell listeners that you will be at the Friends Meeting House tonight on Stark at 7 p.m. Mm-hmm. That's Brian Wilson at the Friends Meeting House at 7 p.m. tonight. And also urge people to check out Wilson's contributions all over the web, but also in the collection from the Alliance for Global Justice, Live from Nicaragua, Uprising or Coup, which will provide much more detailed analysis, factual analysis of what has been happening in Nicaragua the last year, and also encourage people to check out Brian Wilson's book, Don't Thank Me for My Service. Thanks again, Brian.
Thank you for having me. Oh!